Welcome to the Sales Leadership Awakening Podcast. I'm Stephen Rosen with my co-host, Colleen Stanley. Colleen, welcome. Nice to see you. And together, we're going to tackle one of the most important areas in sales leadership and help you bridge the gap between knowing what you want to do and actually doing it. Colleen, what do you have to say about the topic?
Well, this topic, I think, transcends any industry you're in, and it's the cost of making a bad hire. I don't know about you, Stephen. I have made some very good hires in my life, and I've made some bad hires. And one of the reasons I think you and I are both excited about this topic is because this is one of these areas that sometimes doesn't hit the P&L statement. You know, we know cost of goods, cost of sales. And I know you sent over some stats, and I'm actually going to look down, that one of the stats you found was that a bad hire cost $1 million. I found another stat that it can be 33% of the base salary. But as you and I have discussed, why this number is so high is, first of all, opportunity cost, right? Ramp up time. We've got to spend time recruiting versus sometimes developing our existing team. The cost of training, the cost of retraining, ramp up time, a workload on other people with the turnover, perhaps a competitor sees an open territory. So this is one that we need to pay attention to, even if it's not landing on your P&L statement.
I think that's so insightful that it's not landing. Where does that cost get recorded? So you've missed on your sales. There's a big cost of opportunity cost, of lost sales, of competitors getting your sales. Those folks who concentrate solely on recruiting and helping managers recruit the right talent, your jobs are just so critical to make sure to get the right people that they can immediately impact performance and long-term as well, that we retain them. Colleen, in your experience, what are the biggest mistakes or what are the biggest hiring issues that customers face or sales leaders face, and how can they avoid them?
There's probably several areas, but you know, one that comes to mind is we don't apply what I'd call that best practice in sales to our hiring process, right? Mm. So generally in sales, we are very focused on ideal client profile because you can't sell to somebody that's not willing and able to buy. But we don't take that same thought or methodology into our hiring profile. So how many companies have really built that avatar? Like, who is your ideal client? Who is your ideal profile? But with that, Stephen, and I bet you've seen this, there are times when they're building out that ideal client hire, okay, we'll call it that, they focus only on the hard skills, past job experience, maybe industry experience, time in the business. Now, those are important, but they often miss some of the soft skills. That could be how well do they play with others departments, some of those emotional intelligence skills. The second, I see people not get very clear about their non-negotiables. This is where you draw that red line and you say, you know what, to be on our team, this is a non-negotiable. I think all of us, when you're hiring, it can be a tiring process, a tedious process. So you want to overlook some of those little red flags. And when you've got your non-negotiables, then you can easily say, no, this candidate is not a fit and does not go any further in our interview process.
I think those are some really great insights, and those in no way should be ever downplayed. I've worked with a company that we actually spent a session on defining what are the key characteristics we're looking for. What makes a successful rep at your company? What's the right education? Sometimes in pharmaceutical, we'd waver between a business background and a science background. Knowing which one's better helps. You know, do they need a degree or not a degree? How many years experience? When you come down to key characteristics, like being a driver, we went around the room and asked managers, what is the number one thing you're looking for? To me, that's critical. And having that on paper, having clarity across your organization on that, I think is key. So you talked about playing as a team, being a team member. What other key emotional areas do you look at in terms of skills that you have found make phenomenal salespeople?
I'm going to go back to the non-negotiable here, because I do think people miss this one. So for example, I wonder how many people have coachability as one of their non-negotiables. And so we all know you can hire a really talented, the resume looks great, but often if you've got a non-coachable salesperson, especially with the way the world's evolving, that's going to be problematic. I know for me, a non-negotiable is victim mentality. So I'm not bringing on somebody that has a victim mentality because usually they're not very coachable. but they're also blame, excuse people. And for me, that's just a non-negotiable there. But going to your question of EQ, there's interesting research out there. I would say one of the data points on the research is hiring assertive salespeople. But let me do the however here. Assertiveness is stating what you need nicely. So we need that to get meetings with decision makers, uncover budget, get clear next steps. However, if you don't have emotional self-awareness and other awareness, I've seen very assertive reps actually assert themselves right out of a meeting because they're not aware of how they're landing on other people, which would also require empathy, which means empathy is a paying attention skill. These are salespeople that develop that habit of being present, which is getting harder and harder with all the technology today. They can hear both conversations, Stephen. So they hear the verbal, which frankly, in my opinion, is easy, but they can hear the nonverbal. They can hear what a person is thinking or feeling without the person saying it. Therefore, they're able to really emotionally connect with people. Those are a few of them, but behind victim mentality or lack of it is someone that has pretty good self-awareness and self-regard, another EQ skill, because they are people that have a confidence to admit, okay, here's a strength and here's a weakness, and I'm going to own both of them. You get these ownership thinking salespeople instead of blame, defend, justify salespeople.
Those are great insights. I look at someone who's coachable, that they actually see their strengths and understand their weaknesses.
Yeah.
That's the easiest person to coach. Of course, the challenge then becomes is certainly knowing your ideal profile. What are you looking for? What works? What do your best reps have? What else do we look at? One of the things I have found is that having a systematic process for hiring, the great starting point is knowing what ideal looks like, almost like selling. What's your ideal client profile? Same as hiring. One thing I've learned is that if we follow a process, we tend to do better at anything we do.
Well, think about it, Stephen. In our world, we're always asking the sales organizations to have a sales playbook. If you don't have a playbook, you can't follow the play, you can't call the play. I bet you've seen in your experience when you've asked the question, can I see your hiring playbook? You get this blank stare. You're like, what are you talking about? So everybody's showing up to the interview, asking whatever question they want. You need to have a hiring playbook that's built around the ideal hiring profile.
These are some of the steps that I don't think it has to be complicated. What I've learned is breaking it down into several components and several iterations with the individuals. You're looking for a couple of things. One is, do they have the right fit? Two, do they have the right skills? Three, do they have the potential to be a strong performer? So one of the ways to break it down is we do what I call fit interviews, and those could be like a 20-minute session, could even be on Zoom, even though Zoom isn't always the best place to do things, but it could be a phone interview like the old days or meeting someone for coffee. Do they have the right background? So you want to look through their resume. Do they have the right background, skills, education? How do they fit your customer in terms of having the right approach? Then, of course, we get into a skill that's very challenging of behavioral event interviewing, understanding very specifically what they've done to be successful and demonstrate a skill with an example. That's a challenging skill that I think takes a lot of training, and given managers don't hire that often, that not all of them become great at doing that. I did learn from one of my sales managers I sat in when I was VP of sales, and he did an interview and he asked for specificity. Because sometimes people would say, especially in the pharma industry, we did this, because they had a number of sales reps, same customers. We did that, or I would do this, which are tip-offs that you haven't done it.
Yeah. Would is not did. Really, you got to have really good listening skills in an interview, because I don't even think the candidate is trying to mislead you, but in their head, they're like, yeah, I would do that. And we don't catch that little word.
Well, and a part of really great interviewing skills, if we're giving some gems away today, one is stopping that person and saying, what I'm looking for is be very specific. Give me an example, not would, could, but what you did. Because at the end of the day, I'm hiring you, not what you think you should do, but based on things that you've done. Because what you're looking for there is past behavior being an indicator of future behavior. And the last area that even with great interviewing skills, and some people are really good at interviewing, some people, if you do it infrequently, it's hard to get really good, is using some type of assessment, psychometric assessment, to get a sense, to get a more objective view of somebody, because Sometimes we like people in interviews. They're personable. One company I work with, one of the managers love people who are personable. And that's a nice trait, but it doesn't make you successful necessarily. Introverts can be very successful, but they always went for people. And we pulled it out of assessments that, hey, this person is very likable. But then they miss some other things like, are they a driver? Can they self-manage? So adding a component on that's more objective, science-based, but using that as an addition to your process as opposed to your process. It's not the decision maker, but it certainly provides you with another set of inputs on a very important decision that if you make the wrong one, is going to cost you a lot of money.
Exactly. Well, and this is what's interesting. We all go into the interview and we think we're going to be objective. But the fact is, I know I had happened, this was years ago, and this was back in the day, we'd fly into a town, we'd interview all day in a hotel room, and had this very enthusiastic young lady show up. I was not trained in behavior-based interviewing at the time, so I'm sitting there going, this is me. This is me when I was her age. I will tell you, she was enthusiastic, but she didn't get anything done. Another time, I remember interviewing, and I actually, for some reason, somehow I had purview to this rep's office and was really organized. And again, I'm organized. I like this. Well, she was organized, but she never left the office. So if I had some objective data on self-starting, self-management, even on accountability, taking responsibility, I call it the paper. And you've got to take the paper. And if there's a red flag on that paper, what I'd encourage everyone to do is don't ignore it. The paper is generally accurate. I've had companies ignore the assessment. And I don't know if you have. And what's been the end of that story, Stephen?
Well, it's fascinating. Actually, I have many stories of that. But there was one organization that we implemented using assessment. And we had a relatively new manager, not new to the organization, but from a different country. They went ahead and hired somebody. And usually I'd spend a few minutes just debriefing them on what the profile says or the assessment says, because the best profile is one that you understand what you're reading.
Right.
If you don't understand it, it's not worth it. It's the paper it's on. But if you understand and dig deeper, sometimes you validate or invalidate what it says. That's what you're trying to do. And they went ahead and they made a really bad hire. I had a strong relationship with the head of that organization, the business unit's head, and I pulled out the profile. Said, oh my God, I'm sure I told not to hire this person, because you can see from the assessment, I don't want to say you judge based on assessments, but I can see where the problems are. Basically, they decided that wasn't part of their hiring process. So again, they're inputs, but it's a real shame when you have flags, because that's really what you're looking for. Is there anything that I missed? Assuming great interviewing skills and the same questions for each person, which I didn't mention, but that's important. You follow that sort of systematic approach, but sometimes it's like an insurance policy. Have I missed anything?
Exactly. Well, when you're saying missing anything, it takes me back to something you said before. So when you're looking at vetting a candidate, you're looking at the hard skills and the soft skills. But here's what's interesting on hard skills. I have seen where somebody, and the resume is not fudged. This is 100% accurate. The person made President's Club. You know, they've been in the industry 5 to 7 years. Now let's use this as an example. This is where past experience is a good indicator of future results, unless the past experience, you're going right into the same environment. So I have had really seasoned reps, okay, lots of experience. They took a job with a startup. Now, Steve and I started in business. Fast, furious, no systems or processes. So here you have a very good rep that did well, but they were in an environment where there were established processes and systems. Then they get put into startup world and they are floundering. So I would also encourage people test to see if the past experience is going to succeed in the current experience or environment for which they are interviewing. Sometimes it does not transcend.
That's a great example, because I see that in people's assessments where we look for structure, how much structure someone needs.
If somebody needs a lot of structure, where should they not end up?
Not in a startup environment.
Exactly. It is the thing with startups. It's bad against startups because you get lots of opportunities, but it's fast and furious.
100%. And knowing that, because that, to me, that's a fit issue, right? Do they fit the organization?
Mm-hmm.
When I was running a sales organization, we competed with a large company like Pfizer, which was highly structured. And we were kind of in startup mode. We had some structure. And I used to say, not to pick on Pfizer people, but as an example of a big company, I don't hire from Pfizer because they won't fit, they would die in my organization because it was entrepreneurial. Your territory was your territory, not three other salespeople who sold in that territory. So I think I never equated it, but I liked really the way you put it, that past experience, even if they're leaders club or whatever the case may be, environment does matter. And that's sort of where I touch on the fit component and how much structure and organizational fit, because you got to be really conscientious of that.
Yeah. And something else you just brought up with your example, again, this does not take anything away from somebody that's working for a logo company. But if you've worked for a logo company and now you're going to a brand that's not that well recognized, well, what you have to really seriously vet for, did the brand name open up the door or did the salesperson's individual efforts open up the door? And I'm not taking away anyone that's had lots of success with a logo, but these are the things that where I've seen people get tripped up. You know, another area that I've seen get tripped up is when prospecting. As we know, prospecting is generally the most difficult part of the sales process. It's the one that I've seen clobber sales leaders and CEOs, small business owners. So you have to really vet if you are indeed in a situation where the rep has to source their own lead. Now, we all know it's great if marketing provided inside sales, but let's say that's where you're at as a company. You better dig deep. Has this person ever sourced their own leads? Where'd the lead come from? Was it handed to them? Because I've seen people where when they're interviewing them, the person actually thought they sourced the lead, but actually they didn't. It came from marketing. It came from inside sales. So unless you've got that same structure, you're actually hiring somebody and setting them up to fail because they're going to be charged with generating their own leads and they actually have never done it. So you got to dig deep into that part of the sales hiring and sales process.
Again, that's another great nugget because I just saw that with a client who I spoke to today. We hired his second rep and the guy had the industry experience, but the challenge was prospecting. There are some learnings from that that you got to really understand exactly what you said to prevent that. Now, that probably wasn't $1 million mistake because it's a much smaller company, but having to start over and find someone, yes, there were some learnings, but that just hurts the business. Managers are always under pressure if they have a vacancy, right? It's a hole in their team. The easiest thing to do is hire the person who I call the plug and play. She described them really well, but I'll just give my own take on it. They have industry experience. They may even know the customers. You know, they may even have won awards. So you figure, great, I can hire this person and my life is easy. There's not much training. There's not much coaching. I just let them go.
Plug and play.
Plug and play. But if they're missing those key elements of playing as a team in terms of EQ, if they're not a driver or a self-manager, hiring that person who has those attributes for the first 3 months are not going to be as good as the plug and play. But within 6 months, they're going to surpass the plug and play. We're not hiring for 6 month junctures. We're hiring someone who we assume will be 3-5 years, be able to move up within the organization. If you go and you plug and play somebody and they don't have the right ingredients, they don't have that right sales DNA, experience itself is not going to carry them.
Here's what we've got to take a look at. What's the root cause of pressure, plug and play? It's because, again, sales leaders sometimes don't apply the same methodology by which they're teaching their sales teams. Every good sales leader is going to have a sales activity plan for their salesperson. They've got leading indicators, which is all the activities that lead to a first appointment, first conversation. Well, take the same principles and apply it to sales management. What is your activity plan? It could be coaching, ride-alongs, group sales meetings, and every week, are you recruiting? That should be a part of your activity plan because that keeps you from desperation hiring, which we've all done. You get exhausted, you start rationalizing. So the root cause is you don't have a KPI in for recruiting top talent. Because I remember, I think it was real estate actually, where you were trying to recruit some of the top brokers. And the managing partner, owner, he said to me, it can take a year to get a top producer to move. There might be part of the activity plan is nurturing, right? Nurturing that lead candidate to come over to your company. So again, always look at root cause. Why am I defaulting to plug and play? You're not practicing what you're telling your sales team to do. You don't have an activity plan for recruiting.
There's been companies that sometimes work deal to deal where they sign a deal and then they got to ramp up their sales force. And one particular customer, one of their KPIs was proactive recruiting. that you have at least one person to fill each position in case somebody leaves. I think that's great. The reality, as much as we know that, other pressures come into play, like making numbers, like coaching, like answering reports. One of the gems is really to do that and to do it religiously. And I guess only when it becomes a habit do people actually do it. And that's a hard one. I know I've worked with organizations to help them do that because I never heard the term desperation hiring, but I like it.
But Stephen, if you can take this back to the EQ world, this is a classic example of impulse control or delayed gratification versus instant gratification. When you take a look at delayed gratification activities, it's often what Stephen Covey called the important but not urgent. It's important, but you know what instant gratification is what Covey called important and urgent. So the firefighting is always what takes up our day. So when you have to look at why am I giving into instant gratification, you got to have that self-awareness that you're reacting versus developing and that you're falling into that bucket. So self-awareness on why don't I believe that if I invest time in delayed gratification of building a bench, as you called it, am I not doing it? That's a belief system. Because frankly, when you believe something, you'll figure out the time to do it.
Great point. So here's one thing. You're the expert in emotional intelligence, in EQ, and I'm learning them more time we spend together. Of course, when we know what we're looking for, how do we elicit during the interview process if someone demonstrates the right EQ, the skills that we're looking for? Is it the same as other skills, or do we take a different approach to get a good understanding? Is someone a team player?
So what you do is you really start, you have to take a little bit more time on developing specific questions. So for example, a team player, a question I've taught some of my clients is this: tell me about a time you helped another person on your team achieve a goal, accomplish a milestone without recognition, payment, or credit.
That's a good question.
Now, what you're doing is you're doing what you said. Past experience, best indicator, are they going to do it in the future? But what I'm also looking for by the last part of that, without recognition, payment, et cetera, this is generally a selfless person. Now, I'm not looking for somebody that takes on the problems of the world, but a true team player. I'm going to help you out. I'm going to take the time. Lone Rangers can be very good salespeople, but Lone Rangers only play by themselves. Today, what I think the popular term, we've got these matrix organizations. You've got to have people that are pretty collaborative. You could also ask them, tell me about a time when you had to get a deal across the line by working with other internal departments. What specifically did you do to build relationship, trust, engagement? So then that's a team player that will work with other departments there. On adversity, I've taught people, because of resiliency, when you unpack that, that's a lot about optimism, ownership. And so I might ask the question, tell me about a time when you were charged with hitting a goal, solving a problem, and you got no resources, training, or support. So you're looking for self-starting there. You're looking for somebody that'll get after it. And then when you listen to the answer, you want to listen to that. It's not a resentful answer. I don't want to be hiring angry, resentful people. So people that, you know, tell me about a time you had to accomplish a goal without any support, they just have this thinking like, okay, I can do it, which is optimism. I'll own it. It's up to me. That's a lot of resiliency. So sometimes it's the questions, and then you would obviously follow up with more questions after that.
Summarizing that behavioral interview where we know what we're looking for, which again is critical, and building the right questions to elicit that. It's hard to do them on the spot.
That's why you have to have an interview guide. You have to have a playbook.
100%. And also the belief that you ask each person the same questions because you're evaluating them. And you had talked about it earlier that you go to the hotel room, you're seeing people on the hour or more frequently. I remember I used to come away with that with a headache, and I couldn't remember who was who. Right after you interview 8 people in a day, if you don't make great note, then you're leaving with subjective impressions. Oh, I like that one.
Right. So it's got to be the same set of questions. When I was working with clients on it, we would take a competency and then develop 3 different questions around that competency. So interviewer 1 would ask this question. Interviewer 2 would ask this question. Interviewer 3. So there were 3 different questions, but they were all testing the same competency. Because sometimes good interviewers, as you said, they'll be pretty skilled at answering 1 question. But if you got 2 around the competency, you're actually testing, do they have the depth of experience that we're looking for in that competency?
Then it forces you also to be a little more rigorous in what you're looking for.
Rigorous would be the key.
Yes.
Ruthlessly rigorous would be the key.
Triple R, rigorously, ruthlessly recruiting.
You know what? Three R's and it will pay off, because if you want your life to become easier, get brilliant at hiring. Then you're truly leading. You're not micromanaging. So, Stephen, what's some takeaways you want to leave with our guests today?
Great question. For me, you know, I work with a lot of new managers, and part of what they'll say on a one-on-one coaching says, Stephen, I have to hire. Can you help me? And the first thing I'll do is run them through the process of what are you looking for? This is what a fit interview looks like. This is what you're looking for in behavioral. Maybe they'll use an assessment. Maybe they won't. That depends on the organization. But really what I found is when you follow a consistent approach, even when you're new, you make better decisions, because this is making decisions. It's choosing between, maybe you've interviewed 9 candidates, maybe you've interviewed 3. How do you elicit which one is the best? I do believe having an objective measurement add to the process helps new managers, but also helps tenured managers have that additional objective view of the candidate. So my message is be systematic, like any process, preparation and planning and having a playbook or the same questions written down, making note, which at the end of the day, you forget. Let's say they're being interviewed by other people. If you don't make good notes in the interview on each of those questions that you ask, you forget. I don't care how good a memory you have. So part of what I find is to reduce hiring mistakes, be rigorous, as you said, ruthlessly rigorous, but also follow a defined process. For those who are maybe not that skilled, having the questions help, listening helps, and making notes is almost integral to a good process. How about yourself, Kaleem? What would you like our listeners to walk away with to prevent them from making critical hiring mistakes?
So number one, practice ABR. Always be recruiting. This is like sale. When you consistently prospect, you have a full sales pipeline. Then you're not desperate. You don't think you have to discount. You don't write practice proposals. ABR, always be recruiting. You have a full people pipeline. And so you get to choose who is on your team versus, well, maybe I can settle for who's on the team, which again takes delayed gratification. Examine your belief system. Quit making excuses that you don't have time, because you do have time. Because if you don't take the time to build a people pipeline, you're going to be spending all your time firing people or working with poor performers. So that's ABR. Then the second I would say is just get really clear on your own core values. That's where your non-negotiables come from. And generally, we work well with people that have similar values. In fact, the research shows that if a person aligns in a company that aligns with their values, they're happier, they stay longer. So we as leaders have to get clear on our values, interview for those values. That's the non-negotiables, because everybody gets set up for success.
So, but when you share great insights, it always brings back neuron fires. And I'll just share one story before we wrap up. My belief is coaching is an important part of being a great sales manager. And we had some very high KPIs of days in the field. One of my managers said to me, she says, Stephen, I don't have time to hire. I don't know if I have to replace this rep because I'm busy coaching. I think that's great, but you do need to hire. So I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to add in interview days into your coaching days for your KPI. Let's make sure we're doing the right things for the right reasons. Not having time to recruit is like when you're looking for a spouse and you say, okay, I'm looking for a spouse. Okay, that person will do. You got to spend time on it.
Or else you have to start accepting the excuse from your sales team. I don't have time to prospect. I don't have time to do this. So yeah. Leadership is modeling the behavior you expect. So if you say you don't have time for this, then get ready to accept the same excuse from your sales team.
There you go. Love it. So thank you once again, Kaleem. It's been fun.
Yeah. And thanks everyone for joining us on the Sales Leadership Awakening podcast, where Stephen and I every time do our best to help you bridge the knowing and doing gap.
Thank you.